Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to another exciting episode of Through the Crypto. Today, we're talking China's digital currency will be two-tiered, according to Binance. We got a Portugal tax authority giving us a safe haven for crypto. And then finally, in the main topic, we're discussing the macroeconomics of Bitcoin. Yeah, it's going to be boring as fuck, but it's going to be interesting as hell. Through the Crypto, starting now. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls from around the world, my name is Car Gonzalez. Today is August 30th, 2019. How you doing? Oh my gosh, it's such a great day, right? Beautiful day in Bitcoin and cryptocurrency. Today we're talking a lot of stuff. Might be the most boringest episode we ever release, but you got to eat your vegetables, and this is why we're talking about the macroeconomics of Bitcoin today. But first, let's jump into the news. First up, we have China's digital currency will be two-tiered and replace cash. This is according to a research report from crypto exchange Binance. As they say, China's digital currency will most likely be a two-tiered system replacing notes and coins in circulation. The report issued yesterday claims that the People's Bank of China central bank digital currency will be backed one-to-one by the renminbi fiat, as well as follow a two-tiered structure system with the bank and commercial banks and retail market participants. The report goes on to explain that the first tier will connect the PBOC with commercial banks for currency issuance and redemption. The second layer will connect those commercial banks with the greater retail market. A technical roadmap, including the question use of blockchain technology, has yet to be published, obviously. But according to Binance, the end goal for the CBDC is to display a turnover rate as high as cash while achieving manageable anonymity. Binance said in the report that, in other words, in the first layer network of the CBDC, which is a digital currency, real name institutions are expected to be registered, while the transfer in the second layer network would be anonymous from the perspective of the users. The two-tiered system could help with the People's Bank of China process as many as 300 transactions per second, currently not possible with today's blockchain technology. Binance said smart contracts architecture has also been discussed, but under the Bank of International Settlements, the PBOC's new digital currency could cover general purpose account-based money and central bank digital tokens, which in turn have their own general purpose and wholesale categories. According to Binance, this could be replacing China's notes and coins in circulation, also known as the MO money supply. So in basic terms, the CBDC, this digital currency, is not meant to replace funds within the central bank or money holding institutions. It's an interbank clearing and cross-border payments as practical reasons for replacing the MO with the CBDC. I know that sounds completely crazy and outlandish, but if you look at these charts, I'll put a link in the show notes, you can kind of see what they're doing. This is very insightful because I imagine the United States and other surrounding countries are going to implement something to the likes of this. So something to keep an eye on, something to watch. And this is all expected to release here sometime in November. So we'll keep you up to date with it. Next up, we have Portugal Tax Authority has clarified that both cryptocurrency trading and payments in crypto will not be taxed in the country. This is according to Cointelegraph, reported 3 days ago. Well, according to this report, Portuguese business newspaper Jornal de Negócios, the Portuguese Tax and Customs Authority, have confirmed that crypto transactions or payments are exempt from value-added tax. That's right, the VAT. The agency reported provided the clarification to local crypto mining company, publishing an official ruling document. But in this document, the authority states that the exchange of crypto for fiat money is free of VAT tax, adding that crypto users do not have to pay any income tax. Whoa. So Portugal cites a 2015 ruling for crypto tax exempt. Now, this was an official statement that the Portuguese tax authority cited in 2015, basically ruling by the European Court of Justice regarding the case involving major Swedish Bitcoin portal. That's right, Bitcoin.se, and its moderator, David Hedquist. But at that time that it was reported, the court ordered that Bitcoin is a means of payment and that the exchange should therefore be exempted from VAT obligations. However, the Swedish tax agency subsequently argued against this ruling, claiming that the court did not fully understand the matter. You don't know anything about Bitcoin, they probably thought. So where does this all leave us? Well, it leaves us with Portugal tax authority saying that trading and payments are tax-free when it comes to Bitcoin. That's a win for us. Next up, we have crypto mining malware attacks up 29% in Q1, according to a McAfee report. So McAfee Labs has released its August 2019 threats report, concluding that cryptojacking is on the rise. That's right. Crypto mining malware campaigns climbed 29% from Q4 2018 to Q1 2019, according to the study. Now, McAfee Labs said the campaign was indiscriminate, with both Apple macOS and Microsoft Windows systems seeing a rise in target attacks. Windows products were typically targeted through PowerShell, an interactive command line and automation engine that delegates administrative tasks to the computer itself. By using PowerShell, vulnerabilities in servers were exploited to mine the privacy coin Monero. McAfee Labs said the attack had warm capabilities, allowing to jump from server to server, and malware program Cookie Miner was used against macOS systems to steal private account information stored on users' computers. McAfee Labs also said that account holders in crypto services Binance, Bitstamp, Bittrex, Coinbase, MyEtherWallet, and Poloniex all had personal information stolen. A report from the BBC earlier this week highlighted a Monero crypto jacking virus, which successfully hacked 850,000 servers, mostly in Latin America. French authorities shut down the main server while migrating the virus to unused parts of the internet. This is a real thing. Like in my day job, we deal with this all the time. Like it's pretty crazy, man. Like, especially with all these PowerShell scripts that you can run in the back end, all they need is just some little entrance. And if you're not securing and locking down the network, it could be, it's a mess to clean up, to say the least. According to a Coinbase report, it has been found that 56% of the top 50 universities in the world, mind you, now offer at least one course on cryptocurrency or blockchain, and that's a 25% increase from 2018. The courses cover multiple disciplines, including computer science, engineering, humanities, finance, and more, but the report also ranks the top 50 universities by their involvement in the blockchain ecosystem. Cornell University took the top spot, offering 14 blockchain and cryptocurrency-related courses. It is followed by MIT and New York University. Now, these top universities have also seen increasing demands for blockchain education from students. Out of the 735 students Coinbase surveyed, 34% expressed interest in taking a blockchain-related course, compared to 28% in 2018. Additionally, compared to last year, more students now are interested in applying for blockchain technology courses to benefit society as well, with 20% of the surveyed students interested in learning about using blockchain for social justice, coinciding with the rising interest. Many universities are also offering cross-disciplinary courses that combine cryptocurrency, business, humanities, and other subjects. For example, University of California, Berkeley offers a course that explores the legal implications and potential business models of blockchain technology. And even some students interested in the topic are ones who feel mistrustful of the current banking system. That's according to somebody here at UT, computer science professor Cesar Fracassi. So they want to create an alternative system where the decision-making process isn't centralized. Others are maybe a little more pragmatic and interested in ways this technology can be used to improve companies' performance and efficiency. Yeah, I know during South By, like when we went out there to UT, I had the pleasure of talking to some students that were involved in some of the blockchain and cryptocurrency courses there, and they were ecstatic. Like, they were super excited of where this was all headed. And I know even Jimmy Song teaches a course over there. So, man, it's bullish for Bitcoin and crypto, for sure. Okay, that's all we got for news. It's time for interesting video of the day.
Thriller Podcast. Interesting crypto video of the day.
today's interesting video of the day is from Reason TV. That's right. They just recently hosted a public debate at the Soho Forum in New York City on August 12th. And it features George Selgin, director of Center for Monetary and Financial Alternatives at the Cato Institute, and Bitcoin's own economist, Safedin Almas, author of the Bitcoin Standard. Take a listen.
Whereas with Bitcoin, if you want an instant transaction, it's going to cost you. And that means every time anyone pays for anything, there's going to be an extra cost involved. Now, it's true that there are attempts to reduce this cost, particularly the Lightning Network is mentioned as one attempt to overcome the transaction costs of Bitcoin. But it's still not clear that that will succeed. And it involves, at very least, a second layer of transactions where the whole element of trust, that is one of the key attractive features of Bitcoin, now you have to rely on a centralized party to handle these transactions, which are done off the chain, so to speak. And even so, it doesn't work so well when you have non-repeat transactions. So, now, these are all reasons why Bitcoin is unlikely to be as popular with the average person as it is with many people in this room. And this is the average person's willingness to use Bitcoin as an everyday medium of exchange that matters for its being able to take over an incumbent currency anywhere. Now, having said that, I have to say that it's true that in some countries, not here, not now, but in some countries, the incumbent currencies are terrible. They're hyperinflating. They're losing value very quickly. They impose costs on their the people who use them that are such as could make a currency like Bitcoin seem relatively attractive. In that case, we could say, in those cases, that Bitcoin does meet the necessary conditions, that the necessary conditions for it to take over are met, but those conditions aren't sufficient. And here we come to the other part of the equation. Because even though Bitcoin might be more attractive than some incumbent currencies, before people turn to Bitcoin, they have many other options they could consider that could still be more attractive than Bitcoin. They could turn to the dollar. They could turn to the euro. They could turn to any number of alternative means of payment that would make Bitcoin belong far down the list of prospective rivals. So it's not just the case that Bitcoin has to be more attractive than an established currency. It has to be more attractive than any number of alternative currencies that could be adopted instead of Bitcoin, and that also have, like the US dollar, very large established networks around the world. So for all of these reasons, I think the likelihood of Bitcoin ever becoming any nation's main medium of exchange is vanishingly small. I want to end with one final point. Among these other currencies that could be more attractive than Bitcoin and might have a better chance of becoming a nation's money than it does, I would name other prospective cryptocurrencies. I think it's still a very early stage in the world of cryptocurrency, in the story of cryptocurrency development. And some of these other cryptocurrencies avoid the flaws of Bitcoin that make it a poor candidate. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much, first of all, to the Soho Forum for the invitation and for the opportunity to speak here today. Thank you very much for Professor Selgin for his comments. I'm going to get to the meat of it, I guess, straight away. I think the key thing to keep in mind is that Bitcoin is already working. Bitcoin is functional. It's been operating nonstop for practically 10 years. And it is already, I don't remember the exact number right now, but it is already one of the top 20 largest valued currencies in the world. So it's already bigger than many currencies of many other nation states. And most importantly, in its functional role right now, Bitcoin is the only working alternative to central banks. In other words, if you'd like to send money from here to China, your only option up until the year 2008 was to go through the central bank. Now, after Bitcoin was invented, you're able to do it with the press of a button in an automatic way that doesn't rely on anybody else, in the same way that when you call somebody, you know, you just press a bunch of buttons, but there's nobody needed to let the call go through. It's become a mechanical electronic process that takes, that happens because machines do it, and it's not because people intermediate it. So Bitcoin is already allowing for transfers across international borders and is already breaking central banks' monopoly over that. So I think the notion that Bitcoin has been failing, I think is completely unrealistic. Or the notion that Bitcoin's likelihood of succeeding has been declining and is vanishingly small, I think is contrary to reality, because in reality we see that Bitcoin has been growing nonstop over the last 10 years. And if you've looked at the growth rate and you think that, oh, Bitcoin hasn't grown fast enough over the last 10 years, clearly you haven't looked at the growth rate. It couldn't possibly have grown any could, but it's been an enormously fast growth rate. And the notion that we could get a monetary system, and this is really, I think, the main problem with Professor Seljan's comments, the idea that Bitcoin has to basically be born ready to handle everybody's transactions overnight and to have all of the world's liquidity handed to it overnight from its creation, or else it has failed, I think that is a completely unrealistic way of assessing it. Bitcoin has been growing in every metric that matters, and Bitcoin has been improving in every metric that matters. And there are simply no objectionable reasons why you would say that Bitcoin cannot work as a monetary system. And so to get to the point that Professor Seljan mentions, that Bitcoin, you know, displacing a money is something that is very hard, I think it's not as hard as he makes it out to be. Hundreds of fiat currencies over the 20th century have been destroyed, many several times over each other. Many currencies were destroyed several times, and they were replaced by new currencies or currencies of other countries. Silver was demonetized, seashells, all kinds of other kinds of money have lost their monetary role. And, you know, the people who used to use seashells, their network effect didn't protect them, because when people came into their island with gold, the harder money won. And this is the dynamic that Professor Seljan ignores. Bitcoin isn't a startup that needs to do marketing to attract people. Bitcoin isn't going to win because it's going to, you know, have a better user experience or a, nicer user interface than your Apple Pay or whatever. Bitcoin's value proposition is that it is hard money. And hard money beats out easy money and soft money, because soft money and easy money is easy to overproduce. And so anytime we look at history, and this is what I discuss extensively in my book, you know, when people were using seashells, Europeans arrive, they can make seashells, they can dig out for seashells easily, they flood the supply of seashells, seashells lose their monetary role, people use gold. And the same has happened with many other media. And this is essentially the process that has been going on for the last 10 years with Bitcoin. It's a harder form of money, and it's gaining value because people would rather hold the harder money than the easier money. And also it's gaining value because all of the easier monies are being inflated at a much faster rate. And so that really is Bitcoin's competition. The problem, we can always nitpick with Bitcoin and find things that we think are wrong with Bitcoin, but that is the alternative. That is the only working alternative that can compete with government monies. And the problem with the other currencies that Professor Seljan mentions, and the problem with any other attempt to try and compete or to try and introduce a new monetary standard, the problem that as libertarians, I think people who probably are a lot of libertarians in the crowd, you know, the problem is simply government won't allow a free market monetary system to function because they want to take it over. That's what happened with the gold system. Bitcoin's most important characteristic, probably, other than its hardness, is the fact that it resists government capture and control. Because of the evolution of Bitcoin, and this is something that it doesn't share with any of the other digital coins, which are all centralized because they were all born after Bitcoin, and because, you know, they'd never had the process of a neutral protocol growing on the internet on its own without a person being in charge, because the person who created it disappeared. All the other coins have someone in charge. All the other coins are trivial to compromise and trivial to capture. And therefore, they are not realistic. And any ideas of, they are not realistic competitors to government money. They can be easily shut down. So the reason Bitcoin really can succeed is ultimately because of its hardness and because of its resistance to government capture. And I think those two things trump all the other considerations that Professor Seljan had mentioned.
So the debate is been fairly long. It's about an hour and 20 something minutes, but the conversation is very dense, and it's about the misguided Federal Reserve experiment that we have going on, and prolonged Great Recession and all that kind of stuff dealing from 2018. And then, of course, how Bitcoin and Austrian economics kind of fit into all that. So it's definitely a good listen for that. It's always good to hear multiple sides, even when you disagree. That's what I say. Okay, with that, it's time for Coin Talk. That's right, your favorite part of the day, mine too. Let's do it. Coin Talk, starting now. Ladies and gentlemen, it's time for Coin Talk. Before we do that, got a couple things I want to talk about. So just a quick update. We're going to be headed to Stellar Meridian. That's right, in Mexico City. Hello. Holla. Now we're going to Mexico City here November 4th and 5th. And we're going to check out what Stellar Development Foundation is doing. And we're going to attend the labs, the seminars, the panels, the speakers. We're going to do it all up. And right now, it's still, I think it's priced pretty low. I think it's only like $200 or something like that. So it's a pretty good deal. If you're interested, head over to stellar.org to find out more information. And we're going to cover everything on the podcast. So we'll probably do like multiple episodes, multiple interviews. Hopefully we'll get a Jed McCaleb interview. That's going to be exciting because I don't think I've ever heard a really good interview done about him. I think every person I've ever heard interview him just attacks him, which is kind of stupid. This guy's literally responsible for giving Bitcoin its biggest ramp up, if you ask me. But I'm probably in the minority of that. I think that's all I got. Oh, and then one other thing. You know what? I'll leave that for next time. It's not a big deal. I think, that's all I got. How are you doing? Doing pretty good. Me too. Yeah. Okay, but before we get into anything else, we got to play our disclaimer. That's right. This disclaimer is important because it keeps us out of trouble, right? We don't want to end up like some of these other people that just got arrested here recently from the SEC and fined and everything. So, roll the disclaimer.
Remember, Thriller's podcast does not give financial advice. He cannot tell the future, even if he thinks he can. He is just some dude trying to save the world one Satoshi at a time.
All right. Today we are talking in CoinMarketCap why this is merely a shakeout. No, seriously, we have a CoinMarketCap right now of $246 billion, right? We got Bitcoin dominance at 69.1%. Not quite 70%. Got Bitcoin price at $9,500, up 0.6% on the day. Ethereum at $168, XRP at 25 cents, Bitcoin Cash at $279, and everybody's moving over to Tether because it's a strong $1. So this is going to be a really short coin talk just because we have a massive main topic, and this is definitely an episode of Skip. There was ever an episode of Skip. Car, you're not helping. What are you doing? Well, I'm honest. I'm honest to a fault sometimes. Gosh darn it. Because I recognize the vast majority of people that listen to this podcast just want to know about money. They want to know how they can make more of it. And all they care about is fiat. But there's a large segment of these people that care about where this is all headed and want to know exactly the fundamentals for everything. And this is why I cover topics like macroeconomics of Bitcoin and, the social contract of Bitcoin, stuff you're not seeing anywhere else. Like Tone Vays is not out there talking about social contract of Bitcoin. He's not doing podcasts on it, right? And I love you, Tone. I love you. But you know what I mean? Like, there's everybody has their niche that they're in. And my niche is like talking about topics like this, stuff that I think you need to know and stuff that's important for you to understand, like what you're investing in and where this is all headed. Like one of the people I look up to in this space is Andreas. Like the amount of content that he's released is just crazy, right? So if there's anybody that I'm playing the golf course with right now is Andreas. I'm like looking at him and what he's creating. I'm like, man, how can I do that for podcasts? And how can I make this interesting? But how can I do it in such a way where it literally is aimed towards a younger generation? There is a slight kind of, you know, I don't know what you would call it, like, I guess a factor to what I'm doing here. And it's trying to onboard new people, right? And getting them to understand where this is all headed. So ultimately what I'm getting at is, right now, the price at Bitcoin really doesn't matter. And the reason I say that is because this is the same drop that we've seen multiple times. This is what you would call big whales trying to shake people off. And this is all this is. We didn't even get below $9,100. We're holding that tight support level. So this tells me this is not serious. Like, this is a joke, right? It literally went from like 10,800, 10,700, and people were screaming like, what is going on? $1,000 drop, oh my gosh. Did we fall below $9,100? Did we fall below that major, you know, support level? No, not even close. I think we got to like 94. So this is not serious. This is what happens when you have big whales controlling the market. They want to shake people off so they can get them to dump and buy more Bitcoin, scoop it all up, buy it at a lower price. Anyways, today we're talking the main topic, the macroeconomics of Bitcoin. And this is serious. Like, I want you all to understand this. Please have an open mind when understanding that if Bitcoin's going to scale for the long term, and if we're really serious about where this is all headed, that we need to understand how this works on a macro level. And this is important. So with that, let's get on to the main topic. The macroeconomics of Bitcoin. There are two sides to the study of economics, macroeconomics and microeconomics. As the term implies, macroeconomics look at the overall big picture scenario of the economy. Put simply, it focuses on the way the economy performs as a whole and then analyzes how different sectors of the economy relate to one another to understand how the aggregate functions. This includes looking at variables like unemployment, GDP, and inflation. But how do we look at the macroeconomics of Bitcoin? New Bitcoiners find themselves not only trying to learn some basic cryptography, but also economics and monetary theory as well. Given the complexity of the subject and all the information and disinformation out there, it can be extremely difficult to find clarity. Most critics stress that widespread use of Bitcoin would certainly cause economic calamity. Maybe it will, maybe it won't. But it's foolish to speak with such certainty when the economics is far from settled.
The contrast that I've tried to draw is not markets or the state. Remember that markets are institutions for reducing the transactions cost of impersonal exchange. States are institutions with a monopoly on the legitimate use of force. What we've emphasized is division of labor. Both markets and states organize division of labor, though in different and highly productive ways. States organize protected territories with laws, and markets organize exchange among or between those states. So they have different functions. We can't do without either one. The debate about markets versus states isn't all that interesting. What is interesting is profit-seeking versus rent-seeking, and both of those can happen both in markets and in states. We talked about circumstances where market participants look for ways to have contracts in restraint of trade, to raise prices, to cheat in a variety of ways on the normal rules of free markets. Now, they often need the complicity of the state to accomplish that. So what it means is that large corporations and the state together can provide an alternative to markets that's better for them, but much worse for consumers and taxpayers. We talked about profits, and profits are the actual value that you take for having created value for consumers. Profits are what's left over after you, an entrepreneur, have created value for consumers. Rent seeking is a way that economic power distorts capitalism and political power distorts economic initiative. Rent extraction is probably the worst of all. And the example that you might think of rent extraction was the mud farmers in the Reavers or the robber barons along the Rhine River. Rent extraction is the corrupt practice of changing the rules or using harm to threaten others who create value or have wealth. So we change the rules to take value from someone else. And I wanted to raise the question, how valuable are markets to you? How valuable are access to markets to you? This may not be something that we've thought about, but there's a series of movies online, and I'm just going to show part of this first one. I think of it as iSandwich. Sort of like iPencil, but this is iSandwich. Suppose you wanted a sandwich, but you had no access to markets. What would you have to do? Well, let's suppose it's a turkey sandwich. You would need to grow the wheat for the bread. You need to grow the tomatoes, the lettuce. You need to raise the turkey. But you'd have to get all of those from somewhere. You'd have to get the seeds. You'd have to get the young turkey. We depend on markets for almost everything. The advantage of markets, for all their disadvantages, for all their many disadvantages, the advantage of markets is other people work for you. Other people work for you in all sorts of complicated ways that if you don't think about it, you don't even recognize. Well, let's see what happens when people are denied access to markets. And this is what has been happening in the past couple of years in the relatively wealthy South American country called Venezuela. They have shut down markets. It's not that they lack currency. They have currency. They have money. And it's not that they don't have wealth. Venezuela is one of the top 10 oil-producing countries in the world. It's enormously wealthy. What they don't have is markets. The socialist government nationalized markets, which means they stop functioning. Now, it's entirely possible that you can provide an alternative, but nationalizing markets in and of itself just stops them from functioning. So the question I started out with is, how much would you pay for access to a market? The big problem is we have to choose from among badly imperfect solutions. We need other people to do things for us. We need a lot of people, a lot of things, even if we just want something simple like a sandwich or a pencil. So the single most important thing to remember about everything we've covered so far is that the state doesn't have the information that comes from prices. Whatever problems markets have, and they're real, the information that's contained in the price mechanism as a signal of relative scarcity, giving both in the information and incentive for people to move resources to higher valued uses, is the argument for markets. It's the core argument for markets. And as I've said several times, one way to think about that is, it's immoral for you to use something that someone else values more. It is immoral for you to use something that someone else values more. Without a price mechanism, you have no idea whether that's true. Markets exacerbate income inequality, and in some cases, power inequality. But remember, we have to choose between imperfect alternatives. There's a bunch of bad alternatives. The argument's not that markets are perfect, rather that states and kings are even worse. So you can't say, well, here's a failure of markets, so the state should do it. That doesn't follow. So what I have proposed, as I've said before, is the Munger test. If somebody says, I think the state should do this, stop them and say, okay, but whenever you say state, that's an imaginary thing. What you mean is actual politicians elected in actual elections dominated by concentrated interests. Let's see if you still believe it if you say that. You have to pick actual human beings, because that's what the state is. They lack information. They are not necessarily concerned only for the welfare of the people. States don't have the information that's given by prices, and kings are kings. It's not very egalitarian. Well, let's talk about Bitcoin. And the reason I gave that introduction is that Bitcoin, if you had to guess, is probably going to crash and burn and not exist in 5 years. But there's some chance, if some parts of the Bitcoin software survive, that not only will it become an important currency, but it'll solve a number of the problems that markets have and provide a better alternative to socialism. So the reason to talk about Bitcoin is that it represents a potential radical solution to problems in less developed countries. What Bitcoin matters is for less developed countries. Less developed countries don't have banks. They don't have credit cards. They don't have ways of saving money. They don't have ways of signing binding contracts because they don't have rule of law, honest judges, or police that are not corrupt. Bitcoin can potentially solve all those problems. And that's why it's so exciting. Even if Bitcoin does crash and burn, it's open source software that can be adapted to solve some of these problems.
What is the most striking about the economics of Bitcoin is the juxtaposition of the certainty of supply and the uncertainty of demand. The rate at which Bitcoin is mined has been highly predictable, and unlike almost any other asset, currency, or commodity, its ultimate supply is unknown, quantity fixed in advance. There will never be more than 21 million coins. This feature makes Bitcoin supply almost perfectly inelastic. No matter how high the price rises, miners will not ultimately produce any more than the prescribed amount. Moreover, price rises will not even necessarily incentivize a more rapid mining of Bitcoin. Even if they did, it would mean miners create more Bitcoin today at the expense of creating less of it in the future, since the total supply will reach a hard limit of 21 million coins, expected to be reached by 2140. Bitcoin is mined by computers solving cryptographic math problems in exchange for solving the problems miners receive Bitcoin. Those math problems grow in difficulty over time, increasing the required computational power required to solve them. This in turn drives up the equipment and especially the electricity cost of producing Bitcoins. One needs more and more computers to make them run at peak speeds. They must be kept cool. Even if Bitcoin fails to replace fiat currencies, it will not necessarily be without long-term economic impact. One possible result of the development of cryptocurrencies is that central banks may one day decide to issue their own distributed ledger currencies, like we're seeing today with China.
Now, so the first question I want to kind of think about is, okay, is this money? What does economics tell us? Can we say Bitcoin is money? Is it money at all, right? What makes money money, right? How do we define money? And basically, money is something that's, you know, extremely interesting. Money is defined by its function. It's not kind of defined by its form. So if you think of, you know, what is an apple? An apple, you know, kind of like what an apple is, right? An apple is an apple. A banana cannot be an apple. What is a car? A car has certain functions, has a certain form, right? A car cannot be a train. But what is money? Money doesn't have a certain natural form. Many different things can be money. So money is basically defined by what it does, which is fulfill its function as a medium of exchange. Now, what is a medium of exchange, right? It's something that you use to transact and to buy goods and services with. It's something that we hold on to only so that we can exchange it again to buy goods and services, okay? And so if we look through history, obviously so many things have been money, right? So many examples of different types of commodity monies. And now more recently, we have fiat money, paper money, electronic money. So, I mean, there's no real reason why Bitcoin can't be money. The basic question we kind of have to answer is, can you use Bitcoin today to buy and sell goods and services? Okay, and if you were just thinking of that, is it a medium of exchange today? Can you buy a bunch of things, right? Will people accept Bitcoin from you and give you goods and services in return? And the answer is yes, right? It is a medium of exchange. It is being used as a medium of exchange. It's not extremely widely used yet, so I wouldn't necessarily call it a currency, but it definitely is a medium of exchange, and it is a money, right? I mean, I think to be called a currency, it would have to be something that's extremely widely used, but again, there's no real clear definition there. But, you know, what can you buy with Bitcoin? Well, a lot of stuff today, you know, which brings me to the next point. What type of money is it, right? Okay, if it is a money, then how do we classify it? How do we understand it? Because a lot of people, you know, of course, when it kind of came on the scene, and it's so interesting, you know, to monetary economists, like, what is this? Is this a fiat money, right? Because it obviously does not have any other kind of value behind it. It has no intrinsic value. How do we understand this? So I like to think of it in terms of Mises' classification of the types of money. And so he used three classifications. One was credit money, fiat money, and then commodity money. And we'll kind of go in through it in reverse. So credit money is anything, is money that is going to be redeemable sometime in the future. Okay. But currently it is circulating and being used as cash. So credit money is not something that is very common anymore. It used to be at the time that Mises was writing. So it would kind of be like an equivalent of like a certificate of deposit, you know, circulating in exchange for goods and services. It's not something that people really do anymore. Fiat money, of course, this is, you know, we know what fiat money is, but technically fiat money is something that is backed by a government and it is in circulation because the government, you know, has a legal decree which says this is legal tender, right? There are legal tender laws, it backs it up. And because people have faith in their governments, you know, they trust and use this fiat money. And typically fiat money is also always paper money, right? So what you see with fiat money is that the face value, like a $100 bill and a $10 bill, have the exact same kind of commodity value to them, but they have a very different face value. But what's kind of backing it is the fact that there's a government, there is a monopoly power that is putting its faith into it. Now, the last one, which is commodity money, and Mises classifies it further into money proper and money substitute. So kind of to just give you an idea, what is a money substitute? So a money substitute today would be like your checking account balances, okay? You know, every time you swipe your debit card, right? Your checking account balance is going down and somebody else's checking account balance is going up. That checking account balance is a money substitute. Maybe 150 years ago, there were banks would issue their own notes, bank notes, and those would be money substitutes. So you would go deposit your gold. The gold was the money proper, the commodity money, which had value of itself, right? Value in use, value outside of just the fact that it's a money. That's what a commodity money is. And the money substitute was basically a piece of paper that was redeemable for that money proper. There's been, you know, a lot of kind of debate. So what is Bitcoin? Is it a money substitute? Is it so-called inside money? You know, isn't it redeemable for dollars? And my view is that it's not. It's not an inside money. It's just because there is a very well-developed market between Bitcoin and dollars doesn't make it redeemable for dollars. There's a fine distinction there. Anytime when we use redemption or redeemable on demand, specifically with respect to monetary economics, what that means is you make a deposit of money and somebody promises to give you back that equivalent amount of money on demand, right? There's no price there. It's one for one, right? And that price, I mean, there is no price. That price cannot change. It's one for one. The difference between buying and selling Bitcoin so easily for dollars is that there's a price and that price fluctuates, right? And that's what tells you that's not the same thing as it being redeemable. So it's not like Bitcoin is backed up in any sense by dollars. Just because you can buy and sell them so easily doesn't make it backed up, doesn't make it redeemable. So Bitcoin is not that. It's not a money substitute, which kind of brings me to kind of by elimination, it's the closest thing it is probably commodity money. It comes closest to commodity money because it kind of behaves like a commodity. It doesn't really have a strong value in use outside of the fact that it can be used as a currency. But I mean, the fact that, you know, people chose to hold it, you know, for speculation or for, you know, just for the fact that it was something that was cool, right, in the beginning, before it ever had any exchange value, right? People chose to hold it and to, right, just to buy it and hold on to it and see what'll happen, right? So it did have some kind of value in use, although it's not that obvious, right? It's intangible. It's not something that we think of as a commodity, but the closest it comes to is a commodity money or what would be known as an outside money. Specifically for the fact that it's not backed up, it's not redeemable in any other thing, right? And neither does it have any kind of guarantee from any government. George Selgin actually has an interesting paper where he comes up with this term called synthetic commodity money to classify Bitcoin, which I think is a useful term. He's saying it's exactly kind of like commodity money, but it's synthetic, but it has most of those features that commodity money has. Now, the big question that, you know, this is the question that I find most interesting. Why does anybody use and trust this thing, right? Like, I mean, is it that easy, right? I mean, is it that easy to like start a new currency tomorrow? I could do it, right? I mean, if you know, it's this thing up in the air, right? And people are just buying and putting money into it, and it's fluctuating, and it seems like it's a bad investment, and why are people trusting it, right? And this is an important question to answer. And it's so interesting because when it comes to a medium of exchange, the question of trust is important, okay? So if you think of a medium of exchange, right, versus a consumption good. So consumption good meaning anything that you would consume, right? Like a meal or a car, right? When you drive your car, you're consuming the car, your house, you live in the house, you consume the house, right? A medium of exchange is completely different. You only ever buy and hold on to a medium of exchange because you know that somebody else will take it from you and give you goods for it, right? So think of how difficult it is for a new currency, okay? Nobody's ever heard of this thing, right? Everybody already has their own money, okay? Why should anybody ever hold on to it, right? If I want to hold on to this and I need to trust somebody else will take it from me, right? But he has that same problem because it's a medium of exchange. If he's gonna take it from me, he needs to know that somebody will take it from him in exchange for goods and services, because this is the primary function of money. This is why we use money. We never consume money, right? It's not like an ice cream. It's not like a car, right? It's not a consumption good. The only reason we ever use a new money. So how does a new currency ever get into circulation, right? People have to trust that somebody else will take it from them. This is a huge problem. So trust, maintaining or creating trust and then maintaining it is key for any new currency. And it's important for an old currency as well, right? You have, right, tomorrow, if, you know, for some reason people lost faith in the dollar or if there was, you know, a massive amount of inflation, people would stop trusting it, right? I mean, something drastic would have to happen at this point, for, you know, with respect to the dollar, but trust is key for currencies. Consumption goods, on the other hand, it's not, I mean, it's important. You have to be able to trust the reputation of the person, but there's an easy test there, right? You consume it. If you like something, if you enjoy it, you buy it. And that's what creates the demand for the thing. But the demand for a new currency only comes from the fact that people know and trust that somebody else will take it from them in exchange for goods and services. And everybody has that same problem, right? So the question becomes, why did anybody ever start to trust this thing ever? To begin with, right? I think it's an important question to kind of think about and answer. So I think there's three features or characteristics of Bitcoin and the blockchain that kind of have lent themselves to why people trust it. So I don't think it's just kind of, you know, up in the air and it's, you know, fickle and it, you know, today people trust it and tomorrow they won't. That's not where it's come from. I think, you know, people trust it for certain solid reasons. The one that are using it as currency, you know, there's solid reasons behind it. And those reasons are, you know, not going to, you know, change anytime soon. So the first one, of course, is the fact that it's a completely publicly verifiable ledger, right? The fact that you don't need to trust any third party who has monopoly power over issuing that money. Nobody has that monopoly power, right? And the fact that everybody knows that creates trust, because you know, even if you're never actually gonna do it, you're like, okay, I'm gonna look this up. Is this really true, right? Did, when I sent Bitcoin to so-and-so, did it actually grow from, even if you don't actually check that up, the fact that you know that it is publicly verifiable, right? That helps create trust, right? That if you wanted to, you could. Okay, the fact that you know that, and everybody seems to verify that, right? That goes a long way to create trust in this thing. The other one, of course, is that it's completely a public blockchain, which is one which is open to everybody, because now there's, you know, there's talk of creating private blockchains, which would be like internal to governments or to companies. But a public blockchain, which is what Bitcoin is based on, is completely open and free, right? There's free entry, there's free exit. So anybody can enter it, right? And then anybody can leave it. And again, that helps generate trust because it's completely decentralized and it's also geographically dispersed. Okay, so it's no one country or no one nationality kind of has monopoly over it, again, and that helps generate trust. And the third one, which is the fact that it's based in open source code, I think is the most significant. So I want to talk about it a little bit. You know, what is open source software? Just very briefly. So open source software obviously has been around for a long time, right? Linux is one of the famous examples. Kind of, let's think of the economics of it and how it works in terms of money. So economists have kind of thought about open source software, but never really in terms of how it applies to money. So the two types of software that you can have is one which is completely owned, which is proprietary, like a Microsoft or an Apple, right? Which is, you know, the stuff that we use, all of us use. And it's owned, it's proprietary, obviously, right? It's something that they charge a price for. It's not free. They have ownership of the code, and they also have control. They have rights over changing that code, right? That's proprietary software. So think of a Microsoft. Open source, on the other hand, is completely different, right? Anybody, it's completely free, right? So today, any of you could download, you know, the Bitcoin code. If you wanted to help change and, you know, give them suggestions of how to fix bugs, and you can do that. Okay, that's what open source is. It relies on voluntary contributions of basically the public to help keep it going and keep fixing it and making it better, right? Of course, the question which, you know, economists think about is like, that's a free rider problem, right? Why would you ever contribute to something that you're not getting a monetary incentive, right? You're not getting any gain from it, but you still contribute to it. And so there's a huge literature in economics which deals with, okay, how do we explain open source software given free rider problems, you know? And what they found is that people still voluntarily choose to contribute because they do, even though they're not paid for it, that they can turn those experiences into like monetizable assets later. Like you can put it on your CV, you can go to Google and say, hey, you know what, I created this bug for an open source software. That means, you know, I'm pretty talented. And, you know, that's how open source has been able to attract really, really talented individuals voluntarily supplying effort and time, right, to just keep this thing going. And that's what Bitcoin is powered by, right? Now, let's think of if a proprietary software like a Microsoft, right, tried to create their own currency. Okay, tried to basically put it out there. You know, this is issued by us. This is whatever, you know, call it whatever. Now, think of the trust problem, right? Everybody knows that Microsoft is privately owned, it's privately controlled, right? That means you know that they have private ownership and control over that code. If they wanted to change it, right? They tell you up front, hey, you know, okay, whatever, it's 21 million units, we're never going to change it. You know, it's all set up just the same way, but you know that they do have power to change it and they do have power to manipulate it in their own favor, right? Because it's based on proprietary software. How many people do you think would trust it? Not very many. That currency would not do very well. Now, Bitcoin, because of the fact that it is based on open source and the fact that everybody knows that it is based on open source, is what goes a long way in the fact that people are able to trust it, right? Because no one person can change it to it's his own personal benefit. There is change that can come about, but it's complicated. It has to come through consensus, right? It has to come through many people agreeing. This is all part of the open source system. And this way of decision making, right? Where everybody kind of has to agree and no one person has power and it's all out in the public. It kind of seems really chaotic. Wouldn't it just be more efficient to, you know, have a central bank, right? Like have somebody that has that power, that has the monopoly over creating decisions and, you know, putting those things out there and just doing things, or a Microsoft that has power to do things, right? Look at this craziness that's out there. Look at these Bitcoin people just fighting with each other right now. It seems chaotic, but it's actually extreme. It's what lends a lot of strength to the whole system of Bitcoin. It's because of all this transparency, it's what leads to a lot of trust, right? It's because everything has to be out in the open. So even if, for example, even if the core developers wanted to kind of change the code for their own favor, in their own favor, they would have to do it in a public way. Everybody would know immediately that it was happening, right? And the moment that happened, most people would stop using it. And the thing is that it's kind of like game theory. The developers know that they know this, right? That other people know that they would do this. So you don't do that because you know you'd be found out immediately and you would lose everything that you've built. That would be the end of Bitcoin, right? Because if you lose trust, if a currency loses trust, right, especially something like this that's completely out of the market, there's no, you know, there's no central bank, there's no FDIC here, right? I mean, it loses trust, it's gone, right? And so the incentive, even if there is an incentive to cheat, to manipulate the code in your favor, the losses would be so great from doing that, right? That actually creates a disincentive to do that.
There was a huge stock market bubble in the late 1920s that ultimately burst and ushered in the Great Depression. There was the dot-com bubble of the 1990s, and of course, the most recent housing bubble that took down our economy in 2008. Yet there is nothing in mainstream theory that even defines what a bubble is, let alone how they form. In fact, many Keynesian economists are still under the impression that there was nothing wrong with the housing market in 2008. In their minds, the housing crash was just brought about by just a garden variety collapse in demand. If demand could have been propped up, the housing prices could have remained at the historic heights. Even to casual observers, they should have a hard time believing that. I know I do. Bitcoin, rather than exacerbating what our economic problems are, would likely bring economic stability. And I say this because the supply of Bitcoins cannot be manipulated by a central bank. It precludes the possibility of interest rate manipulations that lead to resource misallocations. And also, while in discussion of income inequality, this also deserves a strong reason to believe that central bank money printing distorts the distribution of wealth, benefiting the Wall Street banks and large corporations at the expense of the average person. With Bitcoin, that wouldn't be possible. There is so much disagreement among economists over how much money the central bank should print, monetary policy should follow these set of rules, or whether central banks should act this way and this discretion. They also disagree on the effectiveness of money printing in general. This leads some economists to suggest that government should spend the money itself, but in all other cases, the idea that wages and prices do not adjust efficiently shows that the core theory of this is impractical. Bitcoin has a total supply, and it's controlled by an algorithm, not a central bank. If Bitcoin were widely used as money, and if there were a sudden decrease in aggregate demand, there would be no way to expand supply of Bitcoins to pump up demand. For people who hold this view, any monetary system that constrains the supply of money is dangerous, that's what they'll say. It will certainly cause recessions and depressions. But given that we can conduct controlled macroeconomic experiments, there's always going to be some doubt about which one is correct. But given the recent economic turmoil and the lack of consensus among economists, Bitcoin is likely to prove to be a very powerful and useful experiment.
So the hard thing to think about is, what is the physical existence of a Bitcoin? It doesn't exist. Well, last week you heard about dollars. What's the physical existence of most dollars? They don't exist either. The total amount of U.S. currency in circulation, worldwide is less than $3,000 per person in the U.S. U.S. population is a little over 300 million. Total amount of actual physical currency, paper money and coins, is less than $3,000. All the rest of it is stored as a series of zeros and ones on some magnetic or digital medium, magnetic or visual medium. Well, what that means is those dollars don't exist either. We're already using a digital currency. The difference is, how do you know how many dollars you have? Well, you go to the bank and they tell you. What if they change their mind? They'd never do that, would they? Yes. Yes, they would. And it's happened in a lot of countries. Argentina, in particular, just redefined the value of their peso. And that meant that the amount of wealth that people had was cut in half. So it's pretty tenuous. Since all of your wealth is held in the forms of zeros and ones that somebody else controls, it's pretty tenuous. Who controls the digital currency called Bitcoin? No one. Those zeros and ones are stored on millions of nodes. Well, who determines what's right? Simple answer is they use the 51% rule. If half plus one of all the nodes agree on the ledger that goes back all the way through time to the beginning, the first transactions, that's the number of bitcoins you have. Nobody can change it. Nobody acting alone can change it. No powerful person can change it. No one knows where these nodes are. No one knows who or where these nodes are. They're just computers operating somewhere. The simple version of why Bitcoin is important is that Bitcoin may allow countries that now have no rule of law and no financial infrastructure to leapfrog over developed nations. The big obstacle the developing nations have had is they need to develop banks, they need to develop ways to save, they need to develop a system of law, contracts, property. You can skip all of that if Bitcoin works. There's no need to develop those things. And it breaks the monopoly of both governments and large financial intermediaries, banks and credit cards. I mean, it's pretty easy for people in developed nations to use credit cards. However, they charge a pretty significant fee. One of the many things that Bitcoin does is get around that fee, but it's only 2.5-3% on most transactions. So while it's significant, it's not enough alone to explain why Bitcoin would work. But it's one of the things that Bitcoin does, is it gets around monopolistic financial intermediaries that interpose themselves between buyers and sellers. So it's not just a currency, but it's actually an entire system for clearing transactions. Trustless proof, it's decentralized, it uses the blockchain ledger, which is impossible to falsify, and you can't counterfeit or cheat on the number of bitcoins that you have. The key features of Bitcoin is that it's electronic, it has provable value, although its speculative value may fluctuate. It's fast and the transactions are free for now. It's highly divisible. No third-party trust is required. It's uncontrollable in the sense that no central authority can control it. The trades are irreversible. The trades are irreversible. So once I've transferred it, you have it. I can't get it back. And it's international. Well, there's several more comparisons here, but let me say this. If you live in Somalia, and you have a feature phone, and you want to buy something, there's no effective currency. Some people in Somalia use US dollars, some people use pieces of metal, sometimes they just use barter. People in Somalia then find themselves without the benefits of access to markets, which means that they can't get anybody else to work for them. If they do try to write a contract and enforce it, the judges are so corrupt and the police, such as they are so corrupt, that bribes rather than merit of the case determines the outcome. But if I have Bitcoin, I don't need a contract, I don't need a lawyer, and I don't need a bank. You and I come to an agreement, I transfer the money, it is held, in effect, in limbo until you agree and I agree that the terms of the contract have been satisfied. The transaction is then completed and it's irreversible. Fraud is impossible. I can't pay you in counterfeit money. So, in terms of getting around problems with fraud, problems with the absence of financial institutions, and problems with bad judicial or police institutions, the real place that Bitcoin is likely to make a difference is in developing nations. And 10 years from now, we may all remember having talked about it and said, why didn't we see it coming?
So that's a basic overview of the macroeconomics of Bitcoin. Try to keep it as simple and relatively straightforward as I could. But ultimately, this is an ever-expanding invention. Bitcoin truly is. hope you enjoyed this episode. It was a lot of fun putting it together, and I hope you enjoyed it. I want to thank Malivka Anar, Chris Paca, and Professor Michael Munger for all the information that they provided in putting this main topic together. All right, with that, let's get on to the end of the show. All right, ladies and gentlemen, the Thriller Crypto is Dunsies. Thank you so much for listening. Had so much fun putting this together. Don't forget, if you want to listen to any more of our podcasts, head over to thrillerx.com. If you want to check out our Thriller Crypto subscription, head over to thrillercrypto.substack.com. And tomorrow we got a Thriller Coin Talk. That's right, we're going to share my portfolio. We're going to discuss Thriller Insider on Saturday. Should be epic. Bitcoin, say the world. See you next week.
This is the end of the show. You have been listening to Thriller Podcast with Har Gonzalez. Remember, Thriller Podcast is not financial advice. Everything Har said likely won't come true. It is up to you. Now go do your own research. Listen to other dudes that start their name with crypto. And not car. And remember, buy Bitcoin and save the world. One Satoshi at a time.